This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is Clint Locklear. It's getting ready to be convention season for a lot of us. I believe some of y'all have already been to some shows. And that's when I get to do a lot of interviews with a lot of different trappers, some well-known, some not so well-known. Almost every trapper I've ever met has got a story. And if you give them a chance. The story's usually pretty cool if you can, you know, get around the ego and everything else, because most guys have been through some pretty wild stuff that they've been trapping for a while, and there's just some really cool things that you can learn, because it doesn't matter if someone's been trapping just a couple of years or 50 years. You know, if it's an observant person, they learn stuff. And if you can kind of, as the way Slim Peterson does, everybody's got something they can teach you from trapping, but at the same time, you got to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff with what they're saying. So when you're at these conventions, just because someone's not well known doesn't mean it's not somebody you should listen to, because a lot of the state organizations, they'll have local guys that don't write articles, don't make DVDs, aren't doing a lot of the stuff like I do and some of the other guys do, but they're just as good or better trappers than we are. And just because it's a name you don't know, if it's a topic and it's a local guy, there's some local regional stuff that guys have figured out on their local populations that if you go out and you pay attention to what they're saying, it may really help you out on your own personal line. So just because you don't know who they are when you're at these conventions, don't just walk off from it, because you may be missing some very serious information. Now, the PTA and the FTA that's going to be combined, that I'll be leaving for Wednesday, that's going to be in Pennsylvania, I have a feeling that is going to be the biggest show of this year. I don't think it's going to be the NTA this year. You know, God bless the NTA, but why in the world did you have that near about in Canada? I mean, even people in Michigan got to drive 8 hours to get to it. So I don't understand the location this year. I think it's going to be off a little bit. I think it's going to be a great show from everybody that's been up there. They've said it's a beautiful part of the country. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've never been to the UP. But I do think, just being realistic, I think the PA and the FTA show is going to be a bigger show this year, just because of the location that the NTA chose to have it. Because they're asking about anybody, unless you live in the UP, you're going to be driving 6, 8, 10, 12 hours to get to it. And I think that's going to hurt a little bit. Saying that, I think there's still going to be a lot of interesting stuff goes on up there. And it's putting us in a place that at least I've never been. So I'm interested to meet some of the guys that live up there myself. But from a pure size point of view, if you're looking to go to the biggest show this year, I do believe it's going to be the PA and the FTA combination convention that they got going on. Now, I don't know quite how I'm going to say this, but I was listening to a business podcast, and a guy was explaining something that I thought was extremely relevant to trapping. And, you know, it doesn't really have a name, so I'm going to call it the Jeff Dunlap Scale of Trappers, because it really doesn't matter what you call it. But whatever you want to call it, you can call it that. And, but what he said every field, and trapping's a field, you know, regardless of how you look at it, it's a field. Every field has got a hierarchy. And then inside of those hierarchies, you've got people's perception of the hierarchy, no matter which level you're at. And this is what I found, it was interesting. He said, in the business that he's in, you've got everybody that kind of does the same thing. Everybody, you can go to one business to the next, and you'll see basically the same thing, the way they run their operations, the way they do payroll, the way they try to come up with new products, the way that they do their advertising. It's pretty much straight across the board. And I think that is a lot of times a mainstay in trapping. Everybody does, been doing the same thing, going to do the same thing. And if you go on a trap line, say fox trapping in Virginia, you're probably going to see the same thing being done in Pennsylvania. And if someone's setting traps out in Nebraska, you're probably going to see the same thing. You know, same type set, same type lure, same type location, on and on and on. So that's kind of like the base standard. But what was interesting is when he took this on a little bit further, he said, now you've got guys in the industry that are think outside the box. He said, now this is where it gets really squirrely for the main industry and the people that think outside the box. And I'm not talking about me, or I'm not talking about any individual about this, but I think it's something, especially guys, when we're on the internet and you're on Facebook and forums and different things like that, or you meet people at conventions, keep this in mind, what I'm getting ready to tell you, because I think it's pretty much spot on. Okay, you've got the base standard, no matter what the industry is. And then all of a sudden, you've got guys that think out of the box. Or you've got guys that are a little bit better than the standard. Well, everybody that's on the standard looks up to the next guy. Now, if you got someone that's above that other guy that thinks more out of the box or does something a little more production-wise and gets a little more notoriety, the views start changing. They start changing from both directions. If someone is doing better than you, if you're not a jealous type greedy person, you're automatically going to go, that's pretty cool. How's he doing that? And you automatically kind of look up to whatever that person's doing. You know, just because it's out there a little bit and it seems to be working a little bit better. So you get kind of interested. Now the person that's like two levels above them, they're like really cool because they're out there even farther. They're doing some pretty neat stuff and this, that, and the other. Now when you meet people that think way outside of the box, and there's a lot of guys in the trapping industry that are always thinking extremely far out of the box. When they get three or four levels above the standard, at least the way everybody thinks, now they're crazy. Now they're not cool, and they're probably a little dangerous because it's so far out of the norm. Regardless of how isolated trappers want to think we are, humans are herd animals to some degree, especially when you get a bunch of trappers together. So when you see someone that's a little bit above you and you think that's cool, and then you see somebody that's doing something three or four levels above that and you start thinking that person's crazy or whatever, keep in mind why you're thinking that way. Because if that person is doing production at these other levels and the base industry is where it's at, don't you think it makes more sense to pay attention to what that person's doing? Now you may choose not to do what he's doing, but it would least behoove you, no matter what your industry is, to pay attention to that. Now I'm going to go to the reverse of this little theory of Jeff Dunlap's theory of trappers. Because Jeff don't even know I'm saying this. So, how you doing, Jeff? Anyway, so now you've got people that are on the standard, and you've got people that are a little bit different. Their catches are higher. They're a little more well-known. They're coming up with some different sets. They got some different lures. So they're like this other little bitty level up here. They run their lines a different way. It could be anything. Well, their brainwaves are thinking on the level above the other one. So what happens is when someone tries to talk to them about the base standard and why that's the right way to go, the someone above that standard kind of looks and goes, dude, you need to get with the program. Now, when you start talking to someone that's three or four levels above that, however you're going to classify that in trapping, now a lot of these guys are like, you need to get your head out of your butt and do it this way because, or you're out there saying this over and over again and you're not helping the cause because. So it goes both ways. And I think wherever you're at in this Jeff Dunlap's theory of ranking of trappers, you've got to keep that in mind. So if you meet a younger trapper, he's probably going to be more on the industry standard of stuff because he's learning from a lot of times pretty generic type things. He's figuring out processes that everybody went through by himself, and he comes up with stuff and he's all excited, or she is all excited, when they hit a certain level and they learn something and they want to talk to people about it. The worst thing we can do as a trapping industry is squash that person. Because if someone figures out how to catch more coon in a pocket, and then they're talking to somebody that doesn't even set traps in the water for coon anymore, you can see where the thought processes are extremely different. Now, the person that's on more of the industry standard does not need to expect to convert the person that's doing something extremely different. And at the same time, the person that's on this other level that's doing something because he's done been there and done that long enough, or he's thinking a little bit outside the standards, he doesn't need to put down or squash or make fun of the guy that's figuring stuff out from the ground level up. And I think when I see a lot of this nonsense that we see on the computer with trappers basically trying to hack up other trappers, I think that's where it is. And if you realize that when you're talking to somebody that may not be quite at the same level as you, that doesn't make them a bad trapper. Dude, they're trapping. If they're doing something and they're setting still and they're catching animals, pat them on the back. Tell them good job. If you want to go down the road of why you do what you do or think what you think, do it in a constructive way. Make that, help that person be successful. Where, regardless on which level you're at, because that could be open to interpretation. So everybody needs to ask Jess Dunlap how he ranks every trapper when you see him at the next convention, because I really don't know how he ranks it. But regardless of where you're at in this hierarchy, because there is one, I mean, there's no way to get around it. There is in dealers, there is in DVD makers, there is in trappers, and that can be broke down to coon trappers, to coyote trappers, to everything. There's just a natural way that every industry has got, it's just like levels or the way people look at other people. So wherever you're at on that, keep in mind when you're talking to somebody, regardless of their level and regardless of your level, you're talking to a brother trapper. So if someone is still talking about the standard industry, the industry standards, the way it's been since 1970, and they're excited about it, don't just try to, like I said, don't try to suck the air out of them. Try to pump them up a little bit and let them go on about their way. But I just thought that was so interesting, because he was explaining in his business that you had guys that were doing the industry standard and you had guys who were a little bit better, and he was more on the sales size of stuff, and everybody thought they were cool. Then you had the guys that were like the superstar sellers, and everybody just thought they were super cool and wanted to be like them and listen to everything they said. And he said, but then you got guys that are out there in the stratosphere that are breaking ground in really new areas, and everybody just thinks they're absolutely crazy. They need to be locked up. They don't need to have the exposure they've got, because it's threatening the standards the way people want to hold them. And guys, when it comes to trapping, there are no standards. You need to have morals. But when it comes to how you set a trap, or how you dig a hole, or what you put in that hole, or if you do flat sets, or you do this, or you do that, there are no standards. There are no rules. The only thing that we trappers should be concerned about when we're talking to another trapper, that they're actually trapping. They're actually getting something done. And if you look at it that way, I think it could take some of the friction and all the grandma backbiting that you see on the computer right now. Because you've been doing something for 20 years and someone thinks they figured something out that you figured out 10 years ago, does not give you license to start pummeling them just because they're not at your level. Because at the same time, there's going to be somebody above your level that if they wanted to, they probably could just pummel the dog snot out of you publicly, and you wouldn't like that either. So the best thing we can do as trappers is just be decent to other trappers. And if you understand Jeff Dunlap's hierarchy of trapping system, you can kind of keep that in the back of your mind. So if you start feeling your chest get pumped up a little bit, you know, deflate it. And if you're trying to bring somebody down to a more generic standard, understand what you're doing, because it's just a comfort zone. No one likes getting out of their comfort zone. A lot of people do a lot of things to stay in their comfort zone, even if it's detrimental to them. And I'm not going to go into all that, but the basic standards all the way across the board normally are not that efficient. Think about any industry out there that does the same thing and everybody does the same thing. Not a whole lot gets done, and everybody's trying to sit there and fight and scrap over basically nothing. So ask Jeff and he'll tell you where he ranks everybody in the trapping industry, and he'll let you know personally at the Pennsylvania show where you rank on his scale. Okay, now this show is going to be extremely sporadic today. I'm getting waylaid with emails and questions. I would have thought that with fur prices the way they are, that this would have slowed down some, but it hadn't. It's actually picked up, which is kind of odd. My orders are actually picking up more than they were last year at this time, and I greatly appreciate it. Not complaining one bit about it. but it's a little, it's just intriguing to me how this is. So some of these questions, I just picked a bunch of them, and I'm not going to mention full names. I'm probably not going to mention where, and there's a reason, at least on the first one, I'm going to do on that. But it's I'm not the best reader. You know, when I'm reading, I can read with my mouth shut a lot better than I can read with it going open. So, but if someone else is asking a question like this, it's probably a lot of other people have had the question, or at least hopefully something that we say today is going to get somebody thinking. Okay, the first one is an email. It says, "Hello, my name is Jacob T." Now, this is just cool because I want you to listen to the words and the thought process going through this. "I'm 12 years old and I've been trapping since I've been 10. In, I'm not going to say where, because Jacob, there's something we're going to have to talk about here in a minute. And I have a lot of questions on a lot of stuff. I have a farm with lots of coyotes, and there's some sign that might suggest there are bobcats in the area. There's a beaver swamp right up the road that I'm also trapping with permission. So with the coyotes on the farm, there's a ditch that marks the property line. There's a dry creek bed that connects food plots for deer and large ridge halfway up the ridge. I found some scat full of deer, and my dad, who sold the deer plot, is not happy that coyotes are killing our deer. And I would like to know the fastest way to keep these numbers down. I'm getting some more traps this upcoming season. They are Bridgers 175, and I want to know if these will do. I have held some coyotes by mistake in one and a halves. So I thought these would work fine, right? Question mark. And for the bobcats, the reason I suspect them is I found some feathers spread out all over some fairly soft ground with a log over it and claw marks on it. And from what I can tell online, this is bobcat sign. I have some raccoon boxes that I set with 220s and want to know if I set the leaning pole, would it catch bobcats? And I have one last question. Now this one was intriguing, because I had to read it like 10 times to figure out exactly what it was. This is about beavers. I know a substantial amount of info, and I only have one question. Would an 8x8 times 12 piece of wood with nails sticking out over it and an eye bolt on top drown the beaver? Is it too small? If so, what do I need to do? Thanks so much for your time." Okay, Jacob. Dude, you're killing it at 12 years old. Your brain is thinking way beyond my brain thinking when I was 12 years old. So kudos to you on that. Now let's get to some of these questions. Basically, you want to know the fastest way to take care of these animals. The fastest way, hands down, is going to be traps. Now, I didn't mention your state, but since I know where you're at, snares are legal in that state. Snares are something that if you find sign on trails, and I've got other podcasts talking about snares, and I've got a lot of information on Wolf Run Nation where I'm showing setting snares for coyotes. It's a very fast and it's a very simple way that takes a lot of the precision that's needed with foothold traps. So if I was you, I'd get your dad, I'd watch some of the stuff on Wolf Run Nation. I'd get a couple dozen snares, and that's what I would probably start off with right away. Now, your 175 Bridgers, I have not used those. I know Randy Smith used them, I think started last year or the year before, and he really likes them. And Randy's a stickler on quality and good traps. So if he's using them, I guarantee you, you're going to be fine with them. When he told me about them, what he said was they're kind of a trap that's very good on fox and coon and does really good on coyotes up to the part except not having a big enough jaw spread. So what that means, Jacob, is that if you get the foot in the trap, you're probably going to hold the coyote just fine, just like you did with a 170, the one and a half. The issue by using a 175 trap is the size of the jaws. And the smaller traps on coyotes, not that they don't hold well, but you have more misses inside of them, but just because it's a simple fact that they're smaller. And animals do not read trapping books or watch trapping demos, so they don't know they're supposed to step 9-2 or 9-4 or 10-4, whatever it is. They don't know that. So the smaller your trap, the more chance that he's got to get around that. And that's one of the biggest things about it. Now, since Randy's liking these traps, I can only assume that they're really high quality and they can take the abuse of coyotes. So if it's like most breeders, you're not going to have any problem with that whatsoever. At your age, I think that's a good trap, honestly. You don't need to be setting traps just because you see other guys setting traps that if you get caught in it, you can't get out of it. So if you've got it staked down somewhere with a disposable or something, you get your hand caught in it, you don't need to be waiting on somebody to get it out. That trap's probably a good enough size that you can put your knees on it and get your hand out if you happen to get in it. So I think you're going to be perfectly fine with that trap. You're probably right on the bobcat sign. It's either that or bear. You do have bear where you're at that come. They're not there all the time, but they do see it. And the feathers, it's usually not something that a bear goes out and tries to get, but they do cover stuff up. So it's probably a bobcat. I've got a lot of stuff on Wolfer Nation that you can watch on how I'm setting the traps. Not saying my way is the only way, but you can at least see how that I'm doing it. And I use that method in the state that you're from, and it does very well. So that's one thing. And you have some raccoons. Now, this is where I'm going to have to take my teeth out like Granny and talk to you a little bit. I have some raccoon boxes that I set with 220s. Jacob, do not do that in the state that you're in. Let me repeat that. Do not set those in the state that you're in, because if you catch the wrong thing, you're going to be in big, big trouble. You need to check your state laws on that one. Putting a leaning pole to catch a bobcat, because I know what you're talking about. You've probably seen some guys setting it up in Maine and different places where they set the 220 on a branch almost like a fisher, and it's off the ground, and the theory is that the dogs and stuff won't get in it, and they do catch raccoons that way. You won't know if it's to catch bobcats. I really don't know. I would say it would catch a bobcat eventually. I don't think that's your best option. Your best option is going to be the footholds and or the snares, or a combination of both is what I would highly suggest. I don't know enough about the way the law is about you setting the 220s even on a limb. So you and your dad need to sit down and really go over that, because even though it's on your property, you just don't want to be setting something that you're not supposed to be setting in your state. So just keep that in mind. Now about the beavers. Would an 8x8x12 piece of wood, I'm assuming you're talking about like an 8x8 post that's 12 inches long with nails sticking out of it to help drag on the bottom, is that what I'm thinking? I'm on the same track with you here, with an eye bolt on top to drown a beaver. Well, wood floats, so I'm not sure that's going to be your best option. You're going to need weight if you're going to drown the beaver. You're going to need probably a realistic 30 or 40 pounds. Since it's your property, you can have stuff there already on site before season gets there, or if it's just right up the road, ask the people that own the land, can I go and place these? The simplest way that I found, if you're going to use weight on a sliding rig for beaver, is simply if you can walk to it, and if you're going to be scouting, you can go to most, especially at your age, you can go to most auto mechanics, and they have piles and piles of brake rotors. They're made out of metal. They're probably about 15 pounds a piece. You know, two or three of them things wired together on the end of your cable, a beaver is not going to be able to move that around very much. I will say that if you're going to try to put dirt and stuff like that in a bag, it needs to be rocks and dirt, not leaves and loamy soil like you're going to get a lot of times around a beaver swamp, because it'll float. Just like the wood will. Now, I mean, not saying that the wood wouldn't work. I've never heard of that, but I will say that wood floats. And a beaver's extremely powerful, even though he's on the end of a trap. And if you do have your nails sticking out of it, you got to think, when that beaver hits the bottom of that and he starts pulling and trying to get away, you don't want the nails messing with the beaver, because you may get some damage on the beaver, and you don't want to do that. So I would kind of stay away from the nail thing. And I would just go to something that's heavy. You know, you can, if it's somewhere you're going to be trapping, you're going to be setting five or six traps, you can go as simple as a 3-gallon bucket that you can pick up at any bakery for probably a quarter. Get some Pool Creek, have you and your dad go out there and mix that stuff up, put an eye bolt, pour the Pool Creek in there mixed up, put an eye bolt in there, and then you've got a handle that you can carry this thing. It's going to be heavy, it's going to be plenty heavy enough, and that will last you absolutely for years. Even after the plastic gets tore off, it's still going to work just fine. So, you know, that's the way I would do it. Tie plates are hard to get now. At least they are around here. So, but if you've got someone that's got them, any type of scrap metal, you know, I don't care if it's an engine manifold. It doesn't really matter. As long as you can wire to it, you'll be good to go. But being 12 years old and already thinking about stuff like this, dude, you're on the right track. And to other people, listen to how precise he was. Now, like I said, I'm not the best reader, but for a 12-year-old, holy cow, my brain was not anything like this one at all. So good job. And I'm going to go to the next email. This one is, well, this is an interesting one. Okay, this is from a guy in Alaska. We'll just say Hank W. And I was just wondering if Unfair Advantage was waterproof, and I'm a saltwater captain in Alaska. The halibut really like things that glow, and I'm sure it would help out. See, would help our fish catch if it was waterproof. It may add a whole new market to your lure also. Hank, I sent you an email back, but dude, you don't know how many people have asked this. It not so much from Alaska on halibut, but for deep sea fishing, for stuff in the Great Lakes. I guess you're going deep for sea trout that's, not sea trout, but lake trout that's real deep. I've had this over and over again, and I'm going to be playing around with it this summer on catfish. You're not going to have an odor of any kind on there. It's just going to be strictly visual. It is not going to, water is not going to mess with it. And I don't know how long it'll stay on something underwater. I mean, that's just not something I've ever really seriously tested. But there's nothing on there that water can disintegrate either. What I'm worried about where you're at, like I said in the email that I sent you, is the currents and the tides in Alaska, because I was up there for several years, is crazy strong. And I'm not sure if the water pressure going against that is going to just blow it off, you know. But if you're in a slack tide, or you know enough about the water where you're not in this really strong current, I would say that would last 30 minutes or more, maybe an hour. And if it does work for you, and the reason I'm mentioning this email on the air, guys, is if you have Unfair Advantage and you're a cat fisherman, or you're a trout fisherman that's going deep and different things like that, or in Alaska, whatever, if you try the Unfair Advantage out, it glows in the dark and it'll glow for 12 hours. Now, my point is, if it does work for fishing, that means I know I can make it cheaper, because the chemicals won't cost me as much. To get something to glow that long is where the expense of this is coming at. And I don't think needing something that's going to glow over an hour or two for fishing is really needed. So if it does work, and it does stay on, and it does seem to really help the fishing, if anybody's out there that's going to be using this, let me know. I mean, if you're a cat fisherman, you know, like I go down below our dams and stuff, we got some monster catfish, and it is dark down there. And then, you know, when I didn't think about it this year when I was down kayak fishing, there's a shelf off the Gulf. Once I go out about probably about 3/4 mile from where we stay off of 30A, that it drops, you know, it goes from 10 to 15 feet to 10 to 20 feet, something like that. And then all of a sudden I can see the line from the kayak and it goes black. And what the people that live there say that water depth is about 75 to 90 feet. And I've wondered, and I wish I'd have thought about it when I went down this year, because I would have dropped some bait with the unfair advantage just to see. I'll be honest with you, at 90 feet, I get a little nervous in a 12-foot canoe seeing what I pull up. So, but if you're a fisherman and you want to try this and you have luck with it, please let me know. Send me some pictures. I would love to see it. I just think that would be such a cool thing to be able to cross that over to a different market. And for one, if it catches more catfish, I'm all for it. Love fried catfish. Okay, keep this new. Go back to new mail. Okay, this is from Roman A. From Texas, and you wanted me to send you an email, let you know where I was going to be the next two conventions. Like I said before, the next two conventions I'm going to is the FTA and Pennsylvania Trapping Association combo that I believe is next weekend. At least I'm planning to be heading out Wednesday, so I hope it's next weekend. And then the NTA is in UP, Michigan, which will be my next one after that, and that's a little earlier than it has been in the past. So I think it's probably like the third week of July or something like that from what my wife said. As you can tell, I just kind of like, my wife tells me I need to go somewhere, so I go somewhere to a convention. I mean, I kind of set them up, but that's about it. So, but that's the next two conventions I'm going to. The other conventions I'm going to after that, I really don't know. I don't know exactly what I'm going to be doing this year as far as where I'm going and everything. And a lot of it boils down with how the conventions are going and the expense of getting to the convention. Because, you know, gas is back up to $3.60 a gallon, and I got to take that into consideration with motel rooms and everything else. So if I don't show up at your convention, I've been there last couple of years, whatever, it's not personal. It's just, from a business point of view, guys, when I go out to a show and I drive 20 hours round trip, and then 3 or 4 days in the motel, then the food, and then I'm a trapper, so I always buy stuff. So when you throw all that together, you know, a lot of the shows that I go to don't even cover a quarter of what I spend to get there and do that, and I can't do that week after week after week. You know, it's not like I just go to one or two shows. When I'm going to shows, it's a lot of shows, and it's, you know, I spend more going to shows than I do on house payments. So, you know, I got to keep that in mind. So some shows I'll go 1 year and I may not go back for another year or the third year. I want to stay in contact with everybody, but just financially, there's no way anybody can just go to show after show after show every single weekend. You just flat run out of money, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense after a while. Okay, we're gonna go to the next question. Okay, this one may take a while, but really not. Oh, I didn't have this one wrote down, but I'm gonna go ahead and say this. Okay, I guess I'm gonna show my ignorance. I'm in the process of ordering some items before next season. The first time I really noticed the difference between a dog coil spring and a dogless coil spring trap was this year. My question is, when or why do you use one type over the other? Also, do you have any pointers or suggestives or reading material to help me in developing my ADC plan to go along with my fur trapping side of my business? Thanks, Terry L. And he's got a PS, or my providing one-on-one trapping instruction, which I'll get into when I finish the question. A dogless trap and a dog trap. That to me, that's kind of like a Chevy and a Ford type question. There are some awesome traps that have dogs on them, and the dog is just the part that holds the jaws and it you got a piece of metal that goes over the jaw and hooks under the back of the pan. It's more of the classic style way a trap is, if you didn't know what that was. A dogless trap uses a leverage mechanism, so when you push the jaws down and you pull the pan up, part of the pan actually hooks to, most of the time, through one form or another, hooks to the jaw and keeps the trap set. So regardless, when the animal steps on a dogless or a dog trap and the pan goes down, the jaws come up and does its work. Okay, that's good. There's not really a reason to use one or over the other. There's really not. It's more of a personal preference. But there is some things to consider when you're thinking about which trap to use. Do you want dogless or non-dogless? Dogless traps, for the most part, because they hold the pressure of the springs that are attached to the jaws, are going to have more pan tension, which to me and a lot of other trappers is a good thing. But if you want to use that same trap to go after gray fox and mink and muskrats and stuff like that, a lot of times there's too much pressure on there. Even though the pan will flop on the unset trap, even though it can move up and down and it can do whatever, you know, side to side, it seems like it's just floppy. When you hook the trap up and it gets all that tension from the springs from the jaws on it, most dogless traps minimum are going to be about 2¾, 3 pounds. A lot of them are in the 4 pounds. Some, like some of the older MJ600s, are even bumping 5 and 5½ pounds because of the spring tension that's holding that up. So if you want to use a combo trap that you can catch, you know, mink and gray fox and sometimes a coyote with or something like that, I would go with the traps that have a dog on them because you've got more control. Now, saying that, the advantage of the dogless, if it's a well-designed dogless trap, the pan tension is going to be relative to your springs, like I just said. So if the pan tension and you're land trapping and you want to have 3 to 4 pounds of pan tension all the time without having to piddle around when you're out in the field with a screwdriver, that's a huge advantage. Because a nut and bolt on a dog trap, when you catch something, you've always got to, you sit, it seems like at least 50% of the time, you're pulling out a screwdriver and some type of pliers or nut, something, to tighten that thing back up. It's not a big deal, but if you don't forget about it and you start getting toe catches, that's just one of those issues. The dogless trap, you don't have that issue because as long as the springs and everything are strong and good, you're going to have consistent pan tension all the time. I'm getting where I like the dogless traps a lot. Playing with the Bridger number 3s last year, liked them a lot. They're running about 3½ pounds to 4 pounds when I was testing them. That is great for bobcats and coyotes. That's really good for dry land coon if you're back foot catching and stuff like that. But it limits me what I can use that trap on. I'm almost willing to bet on smaller gray fox that they could dance all over that thing and not get caught. Not the trap's fault, it's just doing what it was designed to do, and it's more of a coyote, bobcat type thing, or even for some wolves. So you got to keep that in mind. The other thing I do like about dogless traps is you don't have a dog. So you don't have a floppy piece of metal that's in a coyote's face when they're fighting the trap. And a lot of, you know, there's nothing more aggravating is you've got a disposable trap in the ground, you made a catch, or you've got a drag and you've got the perfect set location and you're running late and tired and everything else. And then you go to set the trap and the dog looks like a pretzel because the coyote munched it. That is frustrating. I don't care who you are, that's frustrating. You know, I've on the bumper of my Jeep, it's made out of, you know, it's an aftermarket bumper. I can take it over there with my hammer, which I've done several times, and just beat the snot out of it till it works. May not work the best, but it'll work. And then, you know, after the season or when I get done with that trip, I've got to remember to go back and fix that dog. I normally don't have that issue with dogless traps. But there's good and bad of both. There's no question about that. I would just really go with what trap feels better and you're more comfortable for using. Because I can tell you, if you've never used a dogless trap, and when you watch people grab something like a Montgomery number 3, which is a good dogless trap, or an old Montgomery, I mean a Montana and a Montgomery, the way that designed, you got to have faith in your equipment. Because when you push those jaws down and you pull that pan up, you got to have faith that little bitty nub of metal is going to hold those jaws. And once you get used to it, you don't think about it anymore. But the first couple dozen times someone gets one of those traps, they're a little afraid to take their fingers off the jaws. Because they can feel the tension. And they know that's a little old bitty piece of metal holding that together. So there's that factor with it, you know, to think about. I think the dogless trap for a beginner trapper, I mean a dog trap for a beginner trapper, is a little more forgiving to use. Because you've got a lot of control when you play with that dog, but that's totally up to you. Pointers or suggestion reading material in developing an ADC plan. I've got a video and it's called Money Making Strategies Something. I think it's like a 6-hour DVD, and it's mostly you staring at my ugly mug while I explain stuff, and I have props and stuff like that to show it. And that goes a lot in the ADC part of the business. I don't really know of anything else on the trapping industry that does that. I think Mike McMillan may have some stuff on developing an ADC plan. He's got videos about ADC trapping, and there's some videos on the actual trapping. The plan for an ADC business, that's the kicker. And I've got some podcasts a while back where I talk about business, and there's some questions you need to be able to answer. What is your business going to be specifically? Who is your customer going to be? And if you say homeowner, you're wrong. You need to have a very specific customer that you can go after. Market to, talk to, advertise to, get to know. It needs to be very specific. The plan part of that, what happens and reason most people fail when they try to do an ADC business is everybody's a customer. Well, you're going to be, it's going to be rough. And the second biggest thing is take the trapping out of the equation. The trapping is the part you like. The trapping is not the part the customer likes. He's got a problem. You know how to fix the problem. What you need to concentrate in on is the business part of the ADC business. And if you take the trapping out of it, it's no different than someone that cuts grass, works on your car, has a tree service where they cut down trees, different things like that. It's a service business. That's what it is. And the biggest recommendation that I can give trappers is to get online, and you're going to go through some really crappy ones before you find some that really hit home to your personality and whatever it is that you're looking for. When I'm out in the lure shop and in the garden, or I'm on the road and I'm traveling, I listen to a lot of podcasts, just like the one you're listening right now, because they're very subject specific. And if you're trying to figure out an ADC business plan, I'm telling you, the internet is the key to your plan. I don't care how much money Orca or these other companies, Terminix, puts into that industry. If you understand the internet and you're willing to do the work and you choose to learn how to do that type thing, you'll be very successful. You can kick money. Money becomes irrelevant online if you understand how to go about it. So how would you learn to do that? I would recommend that you start studying podcasts, because they're simple, because you can do them as you do other tasks, from businesses that are based on internet businesses. FM Broadcast is a really good one. He's a surfer out of Washington. There's a lot of them out there. They're all going to be internet-based business. I would stay away from the business models of IBM and Coca-Cola and the boring guys with the gray little hair on the side of their head. And they're, you know, they're repeating the same crap that they've been teaching since 1940. That's irrelevant now. Absolutely irrelevant. The internet is going to be your key to be getting your customers. Because no one goes to a phone book, so you don't need to be spending $700 a month, depending on where you live, for that phone book. You need to be able to, when they do, just like my wife or I do, or your kids, or the people that you go out and play ball with, when they need to know something, they pick up their smartphone and they Google it. You need to be the person they see when they Google it. It's not that hard. It is a lot of work. It's something you have to dedicate. Or I'm going to put this in a different way. It's something you're going to have to choose. You're going to choose, do you want your business to excel in the internet or not? And if you choose to, then you will make the choice to have a very content-heavy driven website where you're fixing problems for people. Because once you understand in your ADC business that if you fix problems for people, even though a lot of it's not going to be for pay, and I'm talking about internet information, the business comes back to you. And there's a saying when it comes to business, and ADC is the same freaking way. I don't care what anybody says. If you want to meet your dreams or your goals, you help somebody else meet theirs. So if someone's trying to have a perfectly good lawn and they got moles eating them up, you need to be the guy that tells them everything about a mole, where a mole comes from, what a mole is, what a mole looks like, the different methods that they can try to get rid of it themselves, yada, yada, yada. If you still have problems, you can reach us at, you know, wherethemolekillers.com. But don't use that because that'd scare a soccer mom. That's the type of stuff you need to be doing. That to me, that's where it is. But if you take the time to go to the internet business-based blog sites where they interview businesses that are successful, not people that talk about internet, but people that are successful in the internet, you'll pick up some really good things and you'll have light bulbs going off in your head all the time, because it doesn't matter if that person makes homemade journals out of elephant butts and iris leaves. If he can reach a customer, how did they do it? And that's the same way that you're going to do your ADC business. Now, the one-on-one instruction. Terry, and everybody out there, please listen to what I'm saying, because I'm going to be pretty dogmatic about this year. Guys, I just want to go trapping. When I do instruction and I do the schools and different things like that, you got to think, if I set out a line and I've got someone coming for instruction and I'm going to do a good job on instruction, most people just don't want to run the trap line with me. They want to get out and make sets and do this and do that and talk about this. So when I have students or run a school, it really curtails what I get to do. And I've been doing that for several years, and it's really chopped up my trapping season. Guys, I just want to go trapping this year. I want to go out. I want to set traps. I don't want to have to, you know, worrying about if I got to pick somebody up in an airport or if someone is getting what they need to get out of the instruction so I think that they're getting their money's worth, all that type stuff. I'm just going to go trapping this year. If I do any one-on-one, it probably would be just riding along. And I'm not saying that I am. But if I do go back to Texas this year, that's what it's going to be. It's just going to be hold on to your britches and pick up what you can get, and you can ask questions while I'm doing stuff. But the school-type thing that we did where it's 100% for the students, or the way I normally give my instruction, where everything in my world stops for 2 or 3 days for the student, I'm probably not going to do that this year. I'm just going to go trapping. I really don't care what the fur market is. I just want to go trapping again, and that's it. So that's probably what I'm doing. Will I hold a school or do more next year? Maybe, probably. Don't really know. But there we go with that one. Let me save this. Go back to new mail. Okay. Sorry for the dead time. I'm going through the emails as I'm picking these up. Wow. This is from Charlie H. And Cleason, I recently received a call from a landowner who has a coyote problem. They've been finding dead does and fawns, probably killed by coyotes at night and early morning. You can hear them howling and yipping in the woods, and the landowner heard that my trapping buddy have been doing good, clearing coyotes out of small local hunt clubs, approximately 1,500 acres. We caught 22 this year. Of course, that was before and during the breeding season. Food was much more scarce. Now it's hot. Fawns are dropping. Rabbits are on the edge of all the patches, eating grasses and chewing saplings. It's frustrating, to say the least. Yes, we have zero coyotes. We have about 40 sets out with paying attention about 3.5-4 pounds to avoid smaller game. Good job. We've been unlucky enough to catch a handful of coons by the back foot. I'm using 550s and 650s and number 4 dull springs, long springs with large pans. I've had zero activity of an interested coyote around the sets. I'm running about 7% flat sets with natural bait, mostly roadkill rabbits and predator control group baits and lures. I realize this is far from prime time to catch coyotes, but it's hard to say no to the landowner. I need to know a lot other land. I think he's saying the landowner needs another, knows a lot of other landowners. I'd be lying if I said I'm not a little worried. I really thought we would have at least one by now. They're walking right past our sets and lures. I have, I've set each intersection with multiple sets, so the wind direction is not a problem. I can't seem to get their attention. I'm switching gears a bit tomorrow and setting snares and thick ears and hanging a call bag of fish in deer blood, going to create trails into the thick area and also put in blind sets on these created trails. If that doesn't help me break the ice and put a couple in the bed of the pickup truck, it'll be a bit of a loss. And I'm sure if you do any kind of control this time of year, any advice you can offer will be greatly appreciated. Okay, Charlie, this is one of those questions that absolutely I can't answer. But I will give you some insight. I've done a lot of coyote trapping this time of year. I will tell you a couple of things that I've observed over the years. Multiple sets at a location this time of year does not help. Regardless if they're flat sets or not, when it gets warmer, what I've learned is having one set, the best set, the most natural set that I can put at a location is better. When you have three or four together, it's a lot different than it is in the fall because you don't have as many pups running around. And you have coyotes that live there this time of year. And so they know when you do something. The second thing about trapping coyotes when it starts getting warm, it's a time game. Like O'Gorman has said in his books, you can have the perfect set with a perfect lure, with a perfect trap placement at the perfect location, and the coyote picks the time. And he's absolutely right about that. What I've learned from trapping this time of year when it gets hot is most sets don't start working, and you don't really start seeing very many results till about the 14-day mark. Luckily for me, the way my business is set up now is I've got landowners with land managers, and I go set traps, and then I don't have to see those traps again till I go set more traps, and I take the old traps and clean them up. So they're there every day, and they're running, and the guy's there anyway, so it's not a big deal. Yeah, you're going to catch some coyotes a lot of times in the first 2 or 3 days, sometimes 4 or 5 days, but it seems like when you have residential coyotes that live in an area that's got a lot of food, it's just a waiting game. Their curiosity will eventually get the better of them. And they'll go by and they'll work those sets and they'll get caught. And then you'll also have a front come through, and all of a sudden you'll go from zero coyotes to 3 or 4 coyotes in one single day. And you know, then you can go get the hero slaps on the back and all that type of good stuff. But time is the big issue. I mean, it's really big this time of year. I know there's guys that say every time they set a coyote that they catch one, and they don't set a coyote's not going to catch a trap's not going to set a coyote in 3 days and all that bunch of hogwash. But this time of year is drastically different. So if you're on and think about this, if you're on an area that's got a, let's say there's two family groups of coyotes on it, because I don't know how big, I don't know, 1,500 acres is what this ranch is or farm is or what. So if you've got two family groups of coyotes, this time of year, that really means you've got four coyotes, and then you may have some beta coyotes that are still allowed to hang around, and then you got pups. So really the only coyote that's going to be going out and doing anything is going to be the male coyote. The dangerous part of when you take jobs in the summer, if the dens are not on the place that you're setting on, there's very little chance that you're going to have a whole lot of activity. Because back in the fall, and you had all the young pups that are running around trying to find homes and don't know what to eat, and they're very receptive. Now you're in somebody's backyard, and they're only going to go as far in a night as they need to feed themselves and the family. That's it. And when they kill something, it's not like in the fall where they just kind of hang out and go somewhere else. When they kill something this time of year, they take it back to the den because they got mouths to feed. And it's a cruel joke that nature plays that about the time, and everywhere I've ever been, when fawns are hitting the ground, that's about the time that coyote pups need meat. So the female will go out and hunt if it's really close to the den. The male will go out further. If you have some beta coyotes and stuff running around, they'll kind of go out with the male sometimes. If you don't have luck, you know, within about 14 days and it just seems like nothing's working, you know, I would go to the blind sets in the trails right now over the snares, just because there's nothing there. There's nothing to spook a coyote at all in front of them. And I would, if you're going to put out your bait stations, you need to put them out where you've got the trails coming in, somewhere where it's isolated enough that you can put those traps or those snares a good honest 50 to 100 yards away from it. You don't want it close, because the coyote lives there, so he knows something is strange going on. And the closer he gets to that stimulus, the more that coyote is going to start acting squirrely. He'll start getting off of trails. He'll start circling, and you don't know where that's going to be. So the farther back you get that, or if you can find trails that go that allow him to circle at 30, 40, 50 yards, those are probably going to be harder trails than them going in to get the meat. Because he may not go in to actually feed, but he's maybe curious enough to circle around to see if he can figure out what it is. So, you know, you may want to, you know, if you've got a place that you can find two or three game trails that are 30, 40 yards away from just an absolute hellhole of a thicket, and you can drag that stuff in there and you get your fish up and let it start stinking and stuff like that, what the coyotes will normally do is they will get on those game trails and they will go back and forth trying to see, hear, and smell exactly what's going on. They're not going to want to get in the thicker part, especially this time of year, because there's plenty of food around. They're more of a curiosity thing. What's going on in my backyard? So if you find these trails that are allow them to go perpendicular or around where you're putting your bait station, you're better off. And if you need, it sounds like you just need some coyotes right now to show the landowner. If that's the case, I would put in mafia sets, which is it's a very simple blind set. It takes two traps. You find the trails, you be very clean about what you're doing. You don't want to have dirt and disturbance everywhere. It's one of the few times that I think having a kneeling cloth may be a good thing, so you can put your dirt up on it. You bed the both traps for using coal springs. You set one of them in the trail, and then you set the other one in the trail, and you want their levers touching, like on a number three bridger or something like that. You physically want their levers to be touching. And then you're going to take a very small stick and you're going to put it right on the edge where those two levers meet. So the spacing of the traps are going to be the levers. So your coil springs are going to be a better option for this. And then you're going to bed those in, and you're going to blend those in where nothing's going to know that you've been there. And you're still going to have your little stick sticking up right where those two levers come together. Just a little bitty stick. And then you're going to go find some droppings. I don't care if it's from a house cat, a dog, a coyote, a bobcat, a fox. If you can aim good enough, it might work if you do it. But you want a dropping right where you've got that little bitty stick, which is going to put that dropping right on the levers, right where those levers meet. You don't need a big pile. You just need one or two. If you look at droppings in the wild, except for cows, nothing steps on droppings. So when that coyote is going up and down that trail trying to figure out what your bait station is, if you've got those blind sets, and I put three or four of them each one of the trails, and I would definitely keep that pan tension ratcheted up, then you'll probably pick up some coyotes pretty quick. I would also, if you're not having luck at the intersections, pull some of those traps off the intersection and go find some places that you can find coyote sign. Don't think about it in terms of a coyote location. Think about somewhere where deers would be dropping fawns. It's going to be thicker areas. You're going to have trails and stuff like that. Get off those trails a couple feet and put in your blind sets. I mean your flat sets. So don't be thinking about them the way you do in the fall. You got to think about them the way they're going to be working right now. And what they're working right now is fawns hitting the ground. Fawns are not going to be on the side of the road. They're going to be in thicker areas. What you're going to be looking for are the game trails and four-wheeler trails and stuff around the thicker areas. It's got a lot of cover that a deer is going to feel comfortable enough, especially in pine thickets and cedar thickets and stuff like that where there's high grass. That's where they're going to be dropping these fawns, so that's where you need to be having your traps. And that's probably the best advice, but it's always going to be a time issue this time of year. I wish I had a magic bullet, but I don't. It's something you're just going to have to keep piddling around with, you know. But I would cover more locations with just a single trap. And I think I've got a podcast we did a couple of weeks or a month ago talking about coyote locations. You ought to go back and listen to that one. That pertains doubly as much in the summer. If you're going to do the bait stations, catch them when they're circling or tracking around it, not going to it. And then you need to be setting up the areas where the fawns are literally going to be on the ground and not trying to intersect them between hunting and denning. If you can hear the coyotes calling this time of year, they're probably going to be there. So if you hear they're on the side of a ridge or you hear they're on the edge of a field or something like that, don't get closer than 300 or 400 yards from that and start banging around with stakes and stuff. Stay off of that a little bit. You don't want to get right on top of the den, because if you do, you're going to bounce the coyote. And if you bounce the coyote, mama coyote's going to take the baby coyotes and they're going to leave. And then you're going to be trapping for ghost. And the landowner's not going to believe that the coyotes have left. So if you hear them calling from somewhere a couple of days in a row, that's probably going to be really close to the den. Don't get 300 or 400 yards minimum close to that when you put a set in. But you've got to be within, probably a half a mile, three quarters of a mile at the most in most areas, because I'm not sure exactly where you're from, of the den, because the coyotes, just like when it gets hot and your dog wants to sit on the porch and sleep, he's not going to run miles and miles and miles every night. He's going to go out until he finds something and bring it back. So you got to get close enough to be able to intersect that coyote, but not so far away that he's not ever around your stuff. Dude, I hope that helps you. Like I said, I wish I had a silver bullet, because this is the type of questions without me seeing the land and seeing the problem and seeing exactly what you're doing and everything like that. It's just tough. But if you listen to some of the stuff I said, maybe you can rearrange your trap line a little bit so you can start picking some of these up. And if nothing else, hopefully you can pick up enough coyotes that you can get back in there in the fall so you can get the hero back slaps, and then that landowner will be telling all the other landowners. Well, we've been jawjacking for about an hour, so I guess I'm going to call it quits. There won't be a show next weekend because I'll be in Pennsylvania, but that'll give me the opportunity to interview a bunch of people,
so you won't have to listen to me for a little while. And if you have questions that you want to hear on Trapping Radio, you know, email me and just put in here, I have a question I think trappers would like to know the answer to. And if I know the answer to it or I've got an idea about it, I will be glad to talk about it. So let me know what's going on. I hope to see everybody at Pennsylvania. I think it's going to be a blowout show. I really do. So if you're within 6 or 7 hours of there, you really need to try to make it to that show, because it's the last time that the FTA and the PA did this. People are still talking about that show today. It was that big of a show. So till next time, I'll talk to y'all later.